Gavin Hopkins is behind me. Greetings, Mr. Gardner Hopkins. You'll be glad to know that I was thinking dark thoughts about you late last night during due to the failure of arrival of your legal submissions.
That's very regrettable that I've kept you thinking late at night. They had arrived, I think they had been sent yesterday afternoon, but I do acknowledge and need to apologise. That was not consistent with the request that they be submitted earlier. I suppose the one upside is in preparing these submissions, I have had the advantage of seeing the submissions of some of my friends, and so I have sought to avoid repetition, and so hopefully they are more streamlined than they might otherwise have been if they had been filed earlier.
I think you should, Mr. Gardner Hopkins, I think I have read your submissions quickly this morning, but I don't think any of my colleagues have. So I think that you need to take us through them in some detail, maybe not read every word, but certainly try and capture most of what you're saying in your verbal presentation.
Excuse me, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
The copies might be made available to participants.
Can you email Mr. Enright a copy?
Thank you. Email's fine. Thank you.
So, Mr. Gardner Hopkins, you have the floor on behalf of a group of submissions starting, we'll call them Muir et al. So Mr. Muir is the first of your named clients.
Yes, thank you. And he is simply named first because he has numerically the first submitter number of the group, I think. So they're not all listed in order of priority or importance. I suppose just by way of opening, there are four, if you like, main submitters that are listed, and these submissions are given primarily on their behalf. Then in my paragraph two, I do record there are a number of additional submitters who are, if you like, adopting these submissions. And Mr. Giddens is also giving his evidence on behalf of those additional submitters. So just hopefully that is clear in terms of who these submissions are on behalf of. Also just like to thank the Chair for the indication that he has read the submissions, but the other commissioners may not have had the full opportunity to do so. And I'll keep that in mind. It's not generally my practice to read out submissions in their entirety, but rather to talk to them. And I think in terms of time, we do have a reasonable period set aside. I do understand there's been some discussion with other counsel on a number of these issues already. But also just by way of introduction, and I've set out there at the top of my page one just two of the defined terms. And I do just want to pause there because I think both are very important to the panel's consideration and understanding what these provisions are about. And certainly the term wahi tapuna, I was not personally particularly familiar with prior to the notification of this part of the plan. And certainly it extends beyond the concept of wahi tapu or some of the other more perhaps site-specific or particular matters of cultural importance that have come before the courts and have been discussed in the authorities. So that was one aspect that I wished to emphasise. The because it does flow through into what is required to be considered when understanding the Wahi Tupuna overlays, and understanding what properly falls for consideration in a restricted discretionary activity where the discretion is restricted to effects on cultural values relating to Wahi Tupuna. And of course, the question of mana whenua and their views on the importance of any particular place to them and their relationship with it. So that sets some of the context. I think I can move to page 2 of my submissions, and certainly there is no wish by any of the submitters that I act for to downplay the importance of cultural values in terms of process, procedure, and substantively in terms of having appropriate cognition in the planning instruments. And I've referred there to the familiar sections, parts of section 5, 6E, 7A, and 8. And so, as I say, there is no wish to downplay the importance of those matters. But that said, at my paragraph 6, that does not mean any provision that is purporting to protect cultural values will pass muster and necessarily need be adopted. The detail of those provisions and understanding what it is they are intended to achieve, what the anticipated outcomes are likely to be, and understanding the costs and the burden of those outcomes is critical to the assessment of the provisions. I have referenced the paragraph 7, the need to give effect to partially operative RPS, and I don't think there's any contention there that that is part of the statutory requirements for the panel's decision making. Paragraph 8, I refer to the general principle that it is persons who hold mana whenua that are best placed to identify their cultural values and effects on them. I reference there a particular Environment Court case, SKP, and I think that has been provided if the panel wishes to go directly to that authority. But that is a relatively long-standing and generally accepted approach to the assessment of effects on cultural values, that it is mana whenua who are best placed to give evidence on them. But what I do say is there does need to be evidence, and it does need to be probative, and it needs to go beyond mere assertion, particularly if the consequences are additional burdens on other parties. And these submissions then go into a bit more detail on the evidential requirements and the cost-benefit or Section 32 matters in play here. First, and moving on to my page 3, what I've tried to do is identify the key, if you like, issues, and I've termed it problems, with the overlay and the planning consequences that flow from it. In my paragraph 11A through D, I've tried to capture what I understand to be the current lie of the land in terms of the direct planning consequences of the overlay. And I understand that there may be some additional movement in terms of the detail of the rules, but in essence, there are a range of triggers that require restricted discretionary consent. Whilst termed restricted, my submission is that it is quite a broad matter reserved for discretion. Effects on cultural values of mana whenua. And as I say, that goes beyond something that may be quite specific in some contexts, like a site of wahi tapu, or evidence of a very direct cultural association, but a broader consideration of effects on mana whenua in that location. And I do accept that in terms of the relevant schedule and table, there is some focusing through the identification of threats that assists in understanding what are the issues of focus for any particular Wahitapuna area. In terms of the consideration, it's also relevant, and I would put it as high as a mandatory relevant consideration when assessing an application for consent in a Wahitapuna area, to have regard to the objective and the relevant policies. And I've summarised on my page 4 the thrust of those policies. There is an avoid directive in terms of significant adverse effects. I haven't listed it there, but there's also the more common avoid, remedy, or mitigate policy. And then there are, at my paragraph B and C, several policies that I submit are potentially problematic in their application. But the first is the policy encouraging consultation with mana whenua. And the second is the policy recognising that a cultural impact assessment might be required to understand any adverse effects on the cultural values of mana whenua. Then there is a policy relating to limited notification to mana whenua. And putting that together and trying to understand how this might operate in practice, my submission is that together these policies provide a very strong encouragement of consultation, with an implication that if consultation does not occur, then there will be a gap in the information that an applicant has in support of its proposal, which is likely to then trigger, if an application is not then rejected as being incomplete at the outset, but is likely to trigger a request under section 9.2, either for further information or for a cultural impact assessment to be obtained as a separate report. So I do say this inevitably and in practice will result in significant pressure or an incentive for an applicant to obtain support from mana whenua for any activity triggering, I should probably say, a Wahitapuna consent. And I pause there because in my submission that's not the end of the implications or the consequences of these provisions. They do not just apply when a specific Wahitapuna consent requirement is triggered. And I say that because if an application is discretionary or non-compliant, then of course all relevant matters and effects can and should be taken into account by the decision maker. And if the activity is located within a Wahitapuna area in terms of the overlay, then the objective and the policies will all continue to be relevant even if a specific Wahitapuna consent requirement has not been triggered. So my submission is the same thrust and import of those policies will all still apply even in a full discretionary or non-compliant consent application. At 17, I do refer there to some anecdotal reports that this is the sort of thing that is starting to occur in practice, that applications are being put on hold to enable, which could be taken as to require, applicants to undertake that consultation with mana whenua with a very clear preference that agreement be obtained from mana whenua before an application proceeds further. And in my submission, that is one of the costs that is difficult to quantify in terms of the time delays that might generate. It is also difficult to understand the costs of what an applicant might need to do in order to obtain that mana whenua support to then, if you like, unlock the processing of their consent application. But as I develop further, those costs are important and more should have been done to attempt to quantify them so that those costs can be appropriately considered and weighed in the decision-making process. My paragraph 5, I think I've covered, my page 5, I think I've covered paragraphs 18, probably 19. And just pausing, that type of outcome with those sorts of expectations is not necessarily inappropriate if there is a key matter of cultural importance that should be considered through that process. The issue is whether the areas of Wahitapuna have been cast too broadly, and that type of process will be foisted upon applicants when it may not in fact be necessary to protect or to otherwise recognise the relationship of mana whenua with particular sites of importance to them. So that then leads to the panel's consideration about the evidence that it has before it in support of the location of Wahitapuna areas. And I also say it's not just about location. It is also about the type of values, and this is tied in with how the plan responds in terms of identification of threats, but that the evidence on those matters also needs to be clear, probative, and in my submission, compelling, in order for the panel to decide that this set of planning provisions as a response is most appropriate for recognising those matters. I referred to the authorities that the panel was taken to by Mr. Ashton, I think, on Monday, and really just affirm my support for them. And at paragraph 24 and at various places in my submissions, I have referred to the evidence that the panel has now had from council witnesses. And I have tried as faithfully as I can to capture what was said through listening to the recording of the hearings. So at least in terms of the initial mapping, it was based solely and purely, so in effect only, on information from mana whenua the explanation given that was because they are the holders of the knowledge of what is significant to them, that the council completely relied on the submissions of Aokaha to provide the evidentiary basis for the mapping, and that the council hasn't sought to present expert evidence on these issues in its own right. So, for better or worse, the entire evidential burden on these important matters is being left to the mana whenua submitters and their witnesses. In my submission, it would have been a better and more appropriate process if the council had sought to test that information at an early stage of the process, and in my submission through the Section 32 evaluation, rather than putting all of that, if you like, on the panel and the submitters before the panel to seek to test that information. Paragraph 27, I've referred to a decision of Judge Jackson that occurred in the context of the water conservation order, but the observations in my submission are of general application, and it also occurred in the context where there is a dispute as to the admissibility and weight of evidence given by whitewater rafters themselves, effectively in support of their own submissions. And the Environment Court was very clear there that this was not a case where evidence should be excluded, and that evidence from those individuals, and some of them may not have been qualified in the sense of having studied or in the relevant field, but they were recognised as having expertise in terms of the river and its environment, and the Environment Court did place some considerable weight on their evidence and simply said that, as with any evidence, it needs to be tested for relevance, coherence, consistency. Do pause on that, and we'll come back to that issue of consistency, balance, and insight. My submission is it's those factors that the panel needs to keep in mind when considering the evidence of mana whenua witnesses and, in fact, any witnesses before it. Mr. Ashton did refer to the Rena case, which, of course, I have some familiarity with. The context there was, of course, quite different, and there was a very complex tapestry of different interests across iwi, hapu, and other mana whenua entities. But in terms of trying to understand the relationships in particular, the court was very open to receiving and placing weight on independent expert evidence on the issues, and it had evidence there from Sir Witta Gardner and also from Dr. Des Kaitia, and that evidence was received with support from the court. The evidence of Dr. Potiki was not favoured overall by the court, because it sought to emphasise the need for written evidence in support of relationships, but it did not dismiss that evidence as being entirely unhelpful. And so my submission is that this panel or the council could have looked to test the information provided to it by mana whenua through the use of independent experts to assist in understanding, if you like, the key matters robustness, coherence, consistency, balance, and the like, in respect of both the mapping exercise and the details of why those areas are important culturally. My paragraph 32, and this is something that I struggled to try and get my head around. The anticipated outcomes, other than in terms of process, if a site is within a Wahitapuna overlay, and whether specific Wahitapuna consents are required, or if the application is discretionary or non-compliant, the policies give very little indication as to the substantive outcomes, other than sort of avoiding significant adverse effects, or perhaps in respect of some particular activities like cemeteries or otherwise, where there is a very clear direction that they are not anticipated. But my submission is it is very difficult for an applicant to understand if they are scoping out the issues for obtaining consent, what it is they might need to do to modify or in the development of their proposal in order to meet the objective and policies of the Wahitapuna provisions. In my submission, that uncertainty does make the cost-benefit assessment more difficult for the panel to undertake. And I've used in my paragraph 32 an example, and it is quite a different overlay, but in the context of an identified view shaft, it is normally very clear what the intended purpose is, what the anticipated result is, and what the consequences or costs are in terms of restrictions on development that might seek to otherwise intrude into a protected view shaft. So then turning to section 32, and the panel has heard, I think, a fair bit about this already in terms of the legal framework. I think it's fair to say that the Council has frankly acknowledged the approach that it has taken, that it did not seek to quantify costs, and it did not seek to quantify benefits, at least in any numerical type way. It has referred to some processing costs, and the costs of limited notification, but it has not sought to try to collate those costs in a way that might indicate what the costs might be across a large number of applications. And my submission is that more should be done to quantify those costs, even if they can only be weighed against benefits to mana whenua that cannot themselves be quantified in the same way. And that, in my submission, is not uncommon. Protecting landscapes and the like, it is very difficult to quantify those benefits, though sometimes economists do attempt to do so in terms of the benefits to tourism and the like, or trying to understand what some people might pay to protect those sorts of things. But in my submission, there is no impediment to trying to have a cost-benefit evaluation that is partly quantitative and part qualitative. But as I say, we can complain about this all we want, but what does it all mean? And on my page 9, I turn to some authorities on this. I don't think the panel has been taken to these before, but these are the two cases of Kirkland, one in the High Court and one in the Court of Appeal, that refer to what is currently Section 32A, that refers to what the failure to carry out a Section 32 evaluation and how that can only be challenged through a submission, so through a process like this. But what the decision maker is then supposed to do with those sorts of complaints. And it is clear that this panel, and even the Environment Court, does not have a review function. It is not there to strike out, for want of a better term, a plan change or plan provisions because of a failure in the Section 32 assessment, but the adequacy of the Section 32 evaluation and evidence later obtained on cost-benefit matters, in my submission, is highly relevant to the substantive consideration that the panel gives to resolving the question and satisfying itself, are these provisions most appropriate having regard to the evidence before you? At 44, the Court of Appeal did, in terms of a appeal procedural challenge, refer to the ability for someone to seek a speedy judicial review. In my submission, the inadequacy of the Section 32 assessment could well have fallen into that sort of category had somebody taken the case up earlier in the process. But I think we are now beyond that, and so the burden falls on this panel to do its best and, if necessary, to seek further information and evidence before resolving the plan provisions. At 46, I've referred to an observation by the Court of Appeal, and that really is more of a salutary warning to the Council rather than the panel. But if the Section 32 assessment and if the evidence remains entirely unsatisfactory and these matters have to be ventilated again in considerable detail before the Environment Court, then the Court of Appeal has said that that could be a significant factor in terms of costs ultimately against the Council. As I say, not directly for the panel, but for the Council, who no doubt will be thinking about these issues carefully. 47, I do say that if this panel is not satisfied with the information before it, then it is entitled and should seriously consider whether the provisions should be declined or modified in some way so they are a proportionate or appropriate response to the findings that it is able to make on the evidence before it. I do return to relief a little later in the submissions. I want to pause here, just refer to the Section 87BB argument that I think my friend Ms. Baker-Galloway has raised for the panel's consideration. I haven't listened to the audio from yesterday, but it was briefly discussed with Ms. Baker-Galloway on Monday, and my take of that was that my friend was trying to provide some assistance to the panel as to a potential pathway or solution that might make administration of the provisions a little easier in practice. And I don't take issue with that intent. But my submission is that 87BB is not intended to operate in the way that Ms. Baker Galloway put forward, and that the type of marginal non-compliance that section anticipated was a small exceedance of a particular standard rather than the obtaining of a written approval, and that somehow then constituting sort of compliance or resulting in a situation where there might only be marginal or technical non-compliance with the rule. I'm also not sure that that sort of approach would add too much more than the usual process if an applicant can obtain affected party approval. In that situation, effects on the person giving that approval are disregarded, cannot be taken into account, and that no doubt would be highly relevant for whether or not notification is required or whether those issues needed to be considered substantively through any hearing process. So turning to relief, some members that I act for do maintain their primary relief that the Waitapuna regime should be rejected or withdrawn, and a proper evidence-based approach taken to integrating cultural values into the PDP. My submission is that would also enable, as other submitters have emphasised, the development of provisions within the relevant existing chapters and zones, rather than the use of a more blunt overlay mechanism. My submission is that the work undertaken to date would not be lost, and certainly would be the starting point for a more considered district-wide assessment. Mr. Giddens also supports this, the concept of district-wide cultural impact assessment to support a future plan change or variation in respect of settled zones and their provisions. And I suppose this issue is not entirely dissimilar to some of the landscape issues that have arisen. The requests that some submitters have made for a more district-wide or a more basin-wide approach to assessing landscape. And the submission is similar in respect of these mana whenua provisions, Waitapuna provisions. As I say at 55, whilst rejecting an entire chapter might seem like an extreme decision, there is some precedent for that, or at the very least, there are examples of where a council, on seeing the evidence, has withdrawn a change partway through the process following notification. 56, I do note the council has responsibly withdrawn parts of what was originally notified as part of the PDP process in terms of the Waitapuna overlays. I understand that is in instances where the overlay was originally applied to land that had not yet been brought within the PDP. But my submission is that a similar approach could be taken. Again, this is probably talking primarily to the council, but if the evidence that adheres through this process does not support the extension or the application of the Waitapuna overlay in a particular area, then one response would be for the council to withdraw that part of the PDP. At 59, and this may simply have been a slip of the tongue, but in terms of the panel's jurisdiction, when answering questions from the Chair, Commissioner Robinson, about why the Council might not have withdrawn the Waitapuna overlay from the hydro generation zone, As Scott stated, the panel has jurisdiction to withdraw it through submission on a hydro generation design. Now, I did listen to that several times, and the words used were withdraw it. I'm not sure if that was intended to suggest that this panel has the delegated authority to exercise Clause 8D. If it does, then that, of course, then is a tool that the panel may wish to consider exercising. If the delegation doesn't extend that far, then, of course, that can't be considered, and all the panel can do is accept or reject or modify the provisions in the usual way. Paragraph 61, and this returns to the consistency point, recalling that that was an element that should be considered when weighing evidence. As I understand it, the Council Reporting Office's recommendation is to delete Waihitupuna identifications from urban areas. The extent of this is not entirely clear, at least to me, as the deletion might just be supported in respect of the Queenstown and Wanaka urban areas. And the quote there is, in the case of Wanaka and Queenstown, the level of development around the urban areas has cancelled out the need to protect those values. But Ms. Pickard did not suggest that that same approach should be taken to other developed urban areas, such as the townships of Kingston and other townships. And she deferred to the position of Mana Whenua in that regard. In my submission, if the proposition is that if an area, an urban area, has been developed to a certain extent, and that cancels out the need to protect the cultural values or the Waihitupuna values, then that same approach should be taken to all developed areas. And I do emphasize there, again, the township of Kingston. That probably is because one of my clients has a particular interest in Kingston. And I do refer also to the Gibson Valley Resort Zone. I'll come back to that when I touch briefly on the specific site interests. At 62, there seems some uncertainty if there is to be a removal of the Waihitupuna overlay or some of its triggers in urban areas. The question does arise if the overlay remains but no specific consent requirements are triggered. Well, what does that all mean, particularly in the context of a discretionary or non-complying activity where the objective and policies relating to Waihitupuna would still need to be taken into account. So look, I then just wish to turn, and I can probably do this very briefly, to some of the specific concerns of the submitters that I act for, at least the core group. The Muir submission relates to an area of land near the marina. I think the road is Sugar Lane. But on my page 14, outlined in red, is the area that has very recently, by way of consent orders, been changed from a low-density suburban residential zone to business mixed use. That went through the usual appeals process. A slightly unusual feature in that the appeal itself was actually late. So to that extent, it may have stuck out like a sore thumb if somebody was interested in it, because it us, if you like, notified and served separately. But no mana whenua interests sought to submit or join as a 274 party, and the rezoning was settled by consent. And you can see there on page 14, there is a small overlap between the mana whenua overlay and the site that has recently been rezoned. And in my submission, this is a clear example of where some pragmatism might be appropriate to align the extent of any mana whenua overlay with those cadastral boundaries. It is also a situation where that area has largely been already developed. Although it was zoned a low-density suburban residential zone, most of that development is light industrial, and has been there for now a considerable period of time. So my submission on that site-specific issue, there's a very clear, my submission, compelling basis to draw the Wahitapuna overlay back so it does not intrude into the frontage of that new zone. Slightly similar issues arise in respect of Gibson Valley Station. Bottom of my page 14, the area in yellow is the newly rezoned Gibson Valley Resort Zone. And clearly it passes close to, and in some cases does abut, the Kawara River. And over the page on page 15, the extent of the Wahitapuna overlay in respect of the river is just identified there. So again, there is a clear overlap, and any restrictions that might result from that overlap in those overlapping areas were not considered at the time that the Gibson Valley Resort Zone was being settled. And this is, again, very recently been settled by way of consent order. And the provisions of the Gibson Valley Resort Zone, in my submission, reflect quite a careful balance between various competing considerations about the extent of development, the location of development, and the type of development, much of which was geared around ensuring that it was properly within a resort zone concept and met the definition of resort zone. But if the Wahitapuna overlay is to compromise what can be developed, then my submission is that that is a very late upset to the carefully crafted provisions for that zone. And it's an example of why the Wahitapuna provisions should be considered, particularly in the context of any recent rezonings, within that context and with greater detail and understanding of what the consequences might be. Turning to Cardrona Village, and this is probably a unique situation, but also illustrates what I've called something of an arbitrary way in which the Wahitapuna overlay has been applied or identified, at least in some locations. And the issue here is that the location of the river has changed over time. My page 16, there's a blue outline on the image to the left, and that is what used to be the river and the riverbed, but the river has changed course and now flows to the east, I think it is, to the right of area, and that blue area is subject to an agreement with the Crown in terms of a land swap. Some other issues arise, which I'll address the relevant panel members on, around the zoning of that land to settlement zone. But for present purposes, the image on the right shows the identification of the Wahi Tapuna overlay, and it follows the former riverbed, but does not include the current riverbed. And also, and the scale is a little difficult to see, but it appears as if that Wahi Tapuna overlay, at least in terms of the larger parcel of land to the right, is aligned with cadastral boundaries. So we've got an existing example of that. And also, perhaps slightly oddly, the hatched line representing the Wahi Tapuna overlay extends into Soho Street and River Gold Way, but does not extend into the other parts of what is proposed to be zoned settlement area. So it's a little bit odd that the streets are of cultural significance, but the surrounding land isn't. And then finally, my last page, page 17, the Kingston railway interests. And look, the simple point is that this land has been long developed and used for railway purposes. It was originally constructed in the 1890s. I do have to acknowledge the Kingston Flyer is currently on hiatus, but it is in the process of being restored, maintained and repaired for return to commercial use. And whilst on most of the corridor it will just be the running of the train that will be anticipated in the future, a commercial operation may require a discretionary consent. And if the Wahi Tapuna overlay continues to exist over the rail corridor, then the objective and policies will all apply. And it is just a little unclear in this context what the purpose of all of that will be in terms of a substantive outcome, if not participation by Mana Whenua. And it may be a small element if the answer is, well, in that scenario, there may well be no Mana Whenua concerns, and written approval might be obtained and there should be no issue. But the submission is that it presents a risk. It is an unknown and an uncertain situation, and it could be a potential barrier, even a small one, to the return of the Kingston Flyer to operations. And for a entity like the Kingston Flyer, every little barrier is an important issue, and removing any obstacle is seen as being of significant advantage and meaningful for those interests. And so look, with that, those are my submissions. I hope I haven't taken too much time, but certainly I'm very happy to answer questions.
Thank you, Mr. Gowden-Hopkins. Can I take you to page 3 of your submissions, please?
Yes.
The summary of what is now recommended to us. You refer at point A to a continued test of 10 cubes in specific Wahi Tapuna areas. Are any of those specific Wahi Tapuna areas relevant to those parties whom you represent?
would need to double check. I think not was my first look at it. I only noticed the change relatively recently. If I could have leave to come back if I am wrong in that indication and just confirm which submittance might be subject to that rule.
Can we leave it on an exceptions basis? Come back to us if that's not the case?
Yes.
Next question I had for you, I just want to make sure I understand your submissions correctly, and this relates to your section 32 submission. I think that what you're telling me is that based on the case law, the onus is on us to ensure any deficiencies in the section 32 evaluation are corrected, and that the end result, whatever we recommend, has an appropriate evidential and analytical basis. Is that correct? And if not, what would be a correct description?
Yes, that is correct. In essence, my submission is that any inadequacies in the original Section 32 analysis can and should be remedied through this hearing process. And to that extent, it is incumbent on the panel to satisfy itself that it has sufficient information and evidence before it to understand the costs and benefits that then can be weighed in its decision making.
The next point I would make is for your information. It's news to me that we might have been delegated the Council's Clause 8D powers. I don't think we have, and I suspect that it was a slip of the tongue on Ms. Scott's part.
Yes, I suspect that that might be the case, if you like, I got a little bit excited to hear that that prospect might be there.
And in terms of your discussion of the recommendation we've received in relation to urban areas, my understanding of the combined recommendation we've had from Karunaka and from the council team is that the rules of Chapter 39 would not apply to any urban zone land, which would include Kingston, because settlement is treated as an urban zoning.
That is helpful, and look, certainly that move, that amendment, would be supported by my clients. In particular those with the interest in Kingston and other urban areas. My submission is, and I think I've made this clear on the way through, that doesn't necessarily resolve everything, as the objective from policies will still apply, and if the land is still identified as subject to the Waihitupuna overlay, then my submission will be that that objective and those policies would be a mandatory relevant consideration, because an activity would be occurring in an area subject to that overlay. And so some of the uncertainty as to what that means would still loom large in the context of a discretionary or non-compliant consent.
And lastly, or la- presentation. Chapter 5 always foreshadowed there would be a process of this kind. I could envisage you arguing quite cogently in the appeal on Mr. Muir's zoning and the discussions about the Gibson Valley Station zoning, that those matters should be left to this process, since that's what Chapter 5 foreshadowed, and suggesting that it was in fact out of place for Mana Whenua to have appeared on those zoning processes, since Mana Whenua values were treated as a district-wide issue in the district plan. Is that unfair?
I think I would have to accept that as an available approach or an available submission. I had taken it, and maybe this is my more limited involvement, but that if there was an issue of importance to Mana Whenua, then they had the opportunity to participate in site-specific issues. And my submission is, in terms of integrated management, particular function of council, of course, it is and would be better to have these provisions, particularly in the context of a new zone that is subject to its own comprehensive set of policies and rules, to have Mana Whenua issues integrated within that framework. And I think that dovetails into some of the other evidence and submissions that have suggested that rather than a standalone chapter, that Mana Whenua and Wāhi Tupuna issues are better integrated into the other chapters and zones.
And in a similar way, talking about talking about the Gibson Valley Resort Zone rules, you said 71 specific consideration was given to setbacks from the river. Did that consideration include consultation with Mana Whenua and consideration of Mana Whenua values?
Look, I might defer to Mr. Giddens on this. He was involved closely in the provisions. But my understanding is, in the settlement of the zone provisions, specific consideration was not given in terms of those setbacks to Mana Whenua issues. But I would say that is subject to, or was informed by, a cultural impact assessment that had earlier been undertaken for an earlier comprehensive consent for the Gibson Valley area that has now been rezoned. And without looking at the full detail, my submission is that that earlier cultural impact assessment did not indicate that a specific setback was required for cultural reasons. And so by the time it came to the resort zone provisions through this process, the issues were much more about visual amenity and landscape impact.
And lastly, as regards Cadrona, I wondered about the submission that it's arbitrary not to follow the river if the overlay is seeking to recognise historic cultural values. Wouldn't those historic cultural values relate to the area where the river used to be,
Yes, I accept that. I would expect that the cultural values would also extend to where the river now is. And so in terms of consistency, I suppose the alternatives are either the overlay should be applied to the current location of the river, or if both are important, then it should be extended across both the historical path of the river as well as its current. Obviously that submission was less attractive to my client, but I do think any identification should be on a principled basis. The other matter in terms of that site-specific consideration, to the extent that level of disturbance, and in the urban context obviously it's built form development, but to the extent that past disturbance may be relevant to the Mana Whenua values at Cadrona, in that location there is evidence of considerable historic mining, and the submission is therefore, if that disturbance is relevant, just as urban disturbance of built form might be, then that could cancel out, I think to use the phrase of one of the witnesses, the need for the Mana Whenua rules or overlay to apply.
I understand, Mr. Gavin Hopkins. Any other questions for us? Councillor? Commissioner Cheesman?
Just a bit of a clarification around, I think it's sort of paragraph 16 and onward. Are you suggesting that it would be unusual in a discretionary or non-complying consent scenario that those broad, very broad Mana Whenua values should be considered?
No, I'm not suggesting that. What I'm suggesting is that the specific, the existence of the overlay together with the, I'll call it problematic, policies around consultation and obtaining a CIA and the expectations, at least as I interpret them, that sets up, that is the issue in this particular circumstance. My submission is that's quite different to where there might be a discretionary activity and there is a particular known Wahitapu site, or there is a particularly known area where there was a landing place that was historically used, and in that context, in a discretionary consent, then absolutely the relevant Mana Whenua objectives and policies would be taken into account.
So, at your paragraph 19, the result will be that Mana Whenua would almost never be excluded from participation in the process. Is that linking back to a discretionary or a non-complying?
Yes, in my submission, within any area that is subject to a mapped Mana Whenua overlay, then even if a Mana Whenua consent isn't triggered, my submission is because a site would be within that overlay, that would then lead the processing planner or the relevant officer to look at the objective and policies, and the way that those policies are currently set up is that they have a very strong emphasis on the participation of mana whenua in that context, even if there isn't a specific wahitapuna consent trigger.
Following up, Mr. Gardner Hopkins, is that a bad thing?
Well, it comes back to if there is an evidential basis for the wahitapuna overlay, then probably not. But I do think the costs of that, and I may not have expanded on it, but there is that's my paragraph 21 on the same page. You know, there are some real practical issues about the resourcing of these matters and how mana whenua can participate if it is appropriate for them to do so. And I'm not sure that a very broad overlay applied to a very large geographic area, which then triggers consultation, if not CIA expectations for any consent application either triggered by the Wahitapuna rules or that is discretionary or non-compliant, is necessarily appropriate, unless, coming back to that fundamental evidential issue, unless the evidence is that these areas are of sufficient value and there is evidence to that, that makes that participation and expectation appropriate.
Sorry.
It's sort of circular, but hopefully I've expressed the concern.
Just sort of paragraph 25, testing cultural evidence. Are you suggesting that the type of independent expert that would be able or appropriate to undertake that testing would be somebody like Tarwera Gardner, or is that?
Yes, that's my submission, that the evidence could be tested in that way by an independent person who has the cultural expertise to do so in a respectful way, but that would identify, for example, perhaps where further information might be required about a particular location and the extent of its significance, or in terms of teasing out any important cultural values which may differ depending on the location, and making sure that they are accurately identified and translated into, if you like, the threats assessment. And it may be that through that process, there could well be a whittling down or a narrowing to better identify the values that are important so that those values can be protected and understood.
Thank you. And I did just have one on the Cardrona. I think it's Auto. The area there. And it was just, I think the chair's covered it, but I did think if one of the key values is Anatapito, trails is dry on historic riverbeds would probably be quite usual for that kind of value, but I think we've covered that one, so thank you.
Yes. Commissioner Dawson?
No, I don't have any more questions.
Yeah, thank you. And thank you for your submission this morning. Just want to touch on a couple of things. You've drawn our attention to, I suppose, some issues of consistency, and I have noted your guidance around the rural visitor zone and the settlement zones in some cases, and special zones that appear to have been excluded from the Wahi Tapuna mapping. The mapping in the Wahi Tapuna areas cover a range of zones, including rural residential and residential zones and settlement zones or what were township zones, those sort of things. Is it an issue? Are you seeing it as a major issue of consistency that some of the rural visitor zones and special zones have been removed from the mapping where other zones haven't?
Yes, I suppose I come back to the question of consistency and understanding, well, what is the justification for the removal of those zones, and does that same justification apply to a different zone or a different special zone or a different settlement zone or a rural visitor zone? And look, some of that may be require the application of judgment, but if the threshold is that there is either an existing level of development or an anticipated future level of development that means the application of the Wahi Tapuna provisions, I won't say serves no purpose, but will not be that useful in practice, then if that's the justification for removal from an urban area, then that same test should be applied to other zones that might have some of those characteristics in terms of a level of development. And some of those zones sit something in the middle. I suppose to use the Gibson resort zone, it's a resort zone, it's not urban, but it's not quite rural either. It's its own thing. So my submission really is understanding the justification or the principle behind any exclusion and making sure that that is applied consistently.
Yeah, and so in that case, given the approaches we've had about removing the urban environments from the mapping or treating them in a different way, does it make more sense to include those different zones in the mapping but make different provisions for them, or to exclude them from the consistently exclude them from the mapping?
Yes. Look, either is an available approach. It may well depend on the detail of if they are included in the mapping, well, what is the anticipated outcome? And I suppose that my concern is that by maintaining a site or an area within the Wahi Tapuna mapping, that even if the rules that apply are lesser for an urban zone or there are no specific rules, that still has consequences, and those consequences need to be understood so that there is no unanticipated burden put on an applicant, or even an unanticipated burden that is put on Mana Whenua to review and be consulted about a whole slew of applications that actually may not be of concern to Mana Whenua.
Thank you. I'm sure we'll be able to ask the Kaurinanga why some of those areas were included and excluded. Just interested, we had an interesting discussion with Ms. Baker Galloway around this topic, but I'm just interested in, you've highlighted the issues around, I suppose, relying on the expert evidence of the submitter as the basis of this plan change. I'm also interested in sort of the administration of these rules. Given the role that Mana Whenua through Akahu and Akaha and Te Amarama will play in the process around processing resource consents, do you see any conflict with them also being the party that are responsible for an effective party approval?
To some extent, I mean, I think it's an issue that needs to be considered. I suppose what I might submit is that the plan provisions do need to be designed in a way that can be administered sensibly, even if there might be a change in representative entity. And I suppose I come back to, and I quoted it deliberately at the start of my submission, but the definition of mana whenua and the plan provisions are not tied to any particular entity. And whilst I think there is some reasonable understanding as to who represents mana whenua in this district and region, I think the panel needs to bear in mind that in the future that could change, or in the context of a particular site that may be of value and importance to a particular hapu or even a particular whānau that has a very strong association with that particular site, and the provisions need to be workable so that that hapu, that whānau, those individuals who may exercise customary authority and have a strong relationship with that particular site can participate.
Thank you. And that leads to my next question. Is it possible for one organisation to represent, or multiple organisations in that fact, to represent all mana whenua values for the purposes of this, or not?
Yes. I hesitate to say it, but it all depends. In many cases, there is very clear understanding from an iwi or relevant hapu that an iwi authority has the mandate or authority to represent their interests. Over time that can change, and in different locations and different circumstances there could well be more than one entity that has a representative status. And I don't think a plan can exclude that, but it has to be designed with the potential that in the future it may not be as clear-cut as dealing with just one entity.
Thank you. And which I suppose follows to my last question is, we've been directed to rely on the evidence of Kaurinanga as the experts, I suppose, in this topic. Are they the exclusive experts in this topic? And I suppose, if, once again, looking towards procedural matters, is there opportunity for applicants to seek expert advice from other and present expert advice from other parties in the process of such applications?
Yes. In my submission, the short answer is yes. But it obviously all depends on who is available, who feels qualified or able to give that sort of evidence. And of course, some sensitivity needs to be taken on these issues.
Sir, if I just may interject, you do get some guidance in that from policy 5.3.1.4 in chapter 5, which I can talk to.
Thank you. Thank you, that's all I have for the moment. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner Hopkins. Mr. Giddens, we better roll on since we're almost occupied all of the allotted time with Mr. Gardner Hopkins.
He's done a good job.
So please crack on.
Thank you. I understand you've all got my summary evidence in front of you. Just if I start at paragraph 1. I've provided planning evidence in support of a number of submitters as set out in my evidence in chief dated 19 June 2020. My qualifications and experience are detailed in the evidence. The Council's proposal, as stated in the Section 32 report, is to identify sites of cultural significance and to protect the values of Wahitapuna through provisions in the district plan. Primarily, this is through the introduction of a new Chapter 39 and, of course, the new Wahitapuna overland. I do want to stress that I do not disagree with the importance of mana whenua interests in the district, and I support recognising and providing for Wahitapuna and the PDP through support from the Operative Regional Policy Statement and RMA. I summarise the issues raised in my evidence as follows. Firstly, I find difficulties with the process adopted by the Council to get to where we're at with Chapter 39, including what information was relied on to inform the initial Section 32 evaluation that underpins the notified provisions. The result of my LeGroy request confirms that very limited information was relied on. In my opinion, the evaluation falls well short in terms of Section 32.1c, which requires an evaluation to report to contain a level of detail that corresponds to the scale and significance of the environmental, economic, social and cultural effects that are anticipated from the implementation of the proposal. And it also falls short in terms of the costs and benefit analysis and the consideration of reasonably practicable alternatives. Secondly, the timing for including the provisions in Chapter 39 into the PDP is problematic in my view, taking into account that the PDP already includes numerous zonings that are beyond challenge. The proposed provisions have the effect in some cases of unwinding the activities that are enabled through those provisions. Thirdly, the issues around what appears to be the arbitrary mapping of some Wahitapuna areas in the district, which Mr. Gardner Hopkins skipped examples of, and the lack of a cultural impact assessment specific to the properties that are subject to the notified overlay. The burden of the risk, cost and uncertainty are placed on the landowner. I consider this as detrimental in terms of the cost analysis of the proposal under Section 32.2 of the Act. The provisions seek to establish a restricted discretionary planning regime that requires almost all activities within a Wahitapuna overlay into a consenting process that directs the requirement for consultation, a cultural impact assessment and or affected person's approval. If approval is not obtained from mana whenua, the next logical step would be for an application to be considered at a limited notified hearing, which comes with the risk of decline. While I consider that where there would be no doubt be areas and sites that should be afforded such protection, I struggle to see the justification for the overlay in all of its specific locations and the very broad triggers for restricted discretionary status, forcing which what could easily be an expensive and quite protracted consenting process. And finally, I consider it's notable that Chapter 5 of the PDP already contains strategic objectives and policies that give effect to the Regional Policy Statement. In my opinion, there is no need for further duplication of objectives and policies within a district-wide chapter. If there are further provisions that are required to give effect to the higher-order provisions, then I consider the most appropriate place to have them is within the respective zones in Part 3 and 4 of the PDP. This would allow consideration to be given to any new Wahitapuna provisions that sit against those objectives and policies and the rule framework for the respective zones. And I will clarify there that I do believe that Wahitapuna overlay should be incorporated into the district plan. That's quite clear from Chapter 5. In my opinion, it is likely that the provisions will have unintended consequences by increasing uncertainty, cost and risk to landowners subject to the overlay. Turning briefly to the submitter's properties, to the best of my knowledge, I understand that the council has not undertaken a cultural impact assessment on any of these properties. The information that I was provided from the council confirms what information was relied on to ascertain the cultural values under Chapter 39, and it did not identify any information or values specific to the submitter's properties. I'm also unsure if there has been any formal response from the council in regard to my query, which I refer to at 35 of my evidence. And this is where I refer to the situation where the overlay traverses only part of the site, and whether that entire area of that site is affected by the Chapter 39 provisions. And if I can just quickly pause there and take you to Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, page 15, where you have the image of the Gibson Valley Resort Zone. That's quite a good example where you see the overlay traversing a number of properties along the Quarrel River. My understanding from the definition of site, the prior definition of the ODP, you had essentially a carve out where if you had an overlay, it dissected your site into two sites for the purposes of that, of the two different principles. However, I understand that the new definition of site doesn't have that carve out, so I think it would be quite helpful for that to be clarified by the council. And at 8, in conclusion, I consider that there needs to be a balance between the identification of the overlay and managing competing expectations already contained within the PDP to give effect to the operative RPS and other statutory documents, including the MPS for urban development capacity. In my opinion, Chapter 39 should be deleted, with a revised Waiheta Puna overlay included in the PDP that is underpinned by a district-wide cultural impact assessment that provides an evidential basis for the location of the overlay and the values that are to be protected and managed. An alternative option could be to place this process on hold to allow the district-wide CIA to be completed and used to inform the revised set of provisions. I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Mr. Jones. I was intrigued by your statement, 22, you've never experienced a plan change process where Section 32 assessment was undertaken without all the pertinent information being available. I'm thinking you must operate in a rarefied existence because I don't think I've ever been in a plan change where the adequacy of the Section 32 analysis hasn't been challenged, either as to the quality of the analysis or the information that underpins it, or both.
Yep.
Is this an issue of scale and degree?
It is to a degree, but to go back a couple of steps, the reason I made a LaGuardia request in the first place was I was trying to ascertain what information was used and available to inform the decisions and recommendations in the Section 32 report. I found it quite unusual that it was a document that just had the Section 32 evaluation without accompanying reports, and particularly not having a cultural impact assessment, I thought was quite unusual, and that's really where my comment at 22 is coming from. Respectively, it's quite light, the Section 32, in terms of what evidential information has been relied on to form its conclusions. And I think that's quite unique.
And talking about paragraph 25, inconsistencies, and I wondered about the basis on which you've compared Lake Hayes, for instance, to other identified Waiheta Puna areas.
Well, I think it's, and it's just testing my memory here, I believe it's the 1998 regional policy statement had quite a lot of information on Lake Hayes having cultural significance, and also I believe it's in Ngāi Tahu's, I forget the reference of it, there's a website that's available that has quite a detailed background of areas and sites of significance in the South Island, and Lake Hayes is one of those sites. It just strikes me as being very unusual that that would not then be included within a layer.
paragraph 36, the you said that the overlay and the associated rules should exclude the urban areas, excluding resort zones and rural living zones. On what basis do you say that resort zones and rural living zones are urban?
Well, I'm actually saying they're not urban. Resort zone definition from memory specifically excludes it from being deemed an urban area. But the point I'm making in that paragraph is that I believe that the resort zones should not be included within the overlay in the same context that now urban development, the urban areas are not included.
Thank you, Mr.
Yes, I just I wonder if you could take us to chapter 5. You just mentioned when you were discussing Councillor Smith.
Yes.
The context of that comment.
Just going back to Councillor Smith's comment, he and correct me if I have this wrong, Councillor Smith, you were questioning whether Mana Whenua were the only people who could undertake assessments of cultural values. So if you look at paragraph 5, it's actually an issue I've been traversing myself. If you look at paragraph, policy 5.3.1.4, and I'll read that out. That's on page, page numbers. Recognise that only tangata whenua can identify their relationship, and that.
Where are you reading from? 5.1.
Yeah, sorry, chapter 5 and yep. Policy 5.3.1.4.
Is that, do you want, this is the decisions version. Is that the note of my version?
Good point.
Yep.
Gotcha. It's the same wording.
Yep, certainly. It states, recognise that only tangata whenua can identify their relationship and that of their culture and traditions with the ancestral lands, water sites, wahi tapu, tapuni, and other tauanga. And where I think that's relevant is that when you require a cultural impact assessment, I believe that policy is actually quite relevant because that essentially directs that the tangata whenua are the only parties that can undertake that cultural impact assessment. So if you get into a situation looking at the mechanics of how this would work in a consenting process, if you get into a situation where you have a negative cultural impact assessment, that policy to me directs that you would only tangata whenua could provide a contrasting opinion to that cultural impact assessment. So it goes to your question about whether another independent person could provide a cultural impact assessment. I think that policy would actually direct otherwise.
Yeah, I might just follow that up, if that's okay with you. Does that make, in your view, does that make that process unchallengeable, the view of the Mana Whenua unchallengeable in practice?
It would lead to a limited notified hearing. I think that would be inevitable. And I don't know how a party would be able to challenge that without some other contrasting evidential fact. I think it would be very difficult to challenge.
Yeah, I just want to take that a little bit further as well. And I think in practice or the way it works elsewhere and down here, especially with kaitahi, is that there is an ability, whilst the control or mandate is retained, there is ability to delegate the preparation of the CIA. Certainly Diana Jolly does a lot of CIAs down here for Kaitahu, and she's from Canada. But you know, they have obviously ratify or verify the that process. So I think it would be a matter of Mana Whenua having oversight of that process, but it could be something that we could clarify with.
When you look at the policy, there's a definition of tangata whenua, and it says the iwi or hapu that holds mana whenua in a particular area. So that leads me to look at that policy, then link it back to essentially kaitahu, and as being the party that can undertake those assessments. I don't know how a delegation would work in the policy sense. Practically, I agree that it may well be something that could be worked through, but in the policy sense, I think it's quite clear.
Just your district-wide CIA, and I think it could be semantics. I think there are multiple names for cultural impact assessments, cultural effect assessments, cultural values assessments, and so on. Would you be looking at a process like that, drilling down onto individual properties where overlays coincide with that property, and looking at, because it's an impact assessment, not just the values but the threats? There might be some difficulties often when you're doing an impact assessment, you want to know what was proposed or likely to happen to be able to fully complete an impact assessment as such. But I think if you have identified the threats, you could do that to the degree required here. Is that what you're suggesting, that level of detail?
To a degree, I think if you use the Wahi Tupuna overlay as a starting point in terms of where the areas of interest are, as stated by the council in section 32, and use that as very much as a starting point, where, for example, the overlay traverses existing zones, it should be quite clear to identify what activities are enabled already within that zoning framework under the PDP. That could easily, I shouldn't say easily, but that could be looked at against the identified threats, and then some evaluation done there as to whether that site, taking into account its zoning and what's anticipated in the PDP already, whether that on balance should be something that should be protected or otherwise managed, because there's two thresholds in the policy there. There's a protection for policy and there's a management policy. I think that's about the level. I am concerned that, and it comes back to my earlier question as well about the definition of site, but I am concerned that there are a lot of properties that are inadvertently been included over the layer, but there hasn't been an evidential basis to specific to those properties. And is that going one step too far? Maybe. But I do believe that there should be some justification as to why that approach has been taken.
Thank you.
It might only be one question, I think. So I understand your planning position, which is basically to delete the Wahi Tupuna sites and really go through a different process. Does that mean you haven't engaged in the actual objectives, policies and rules very much?
I've kept my evidence relatively high level in that regard. I have taken into account Chapter 5, because I think that's the directive strategic chapter that's of relevance, that directs that there must be a Wahi Tupuna overlay included in the district plan. So I'm not concerned at all about that. It's the mechanics of how that happens within the PDP itself.
We've just been engaged on the plans more specifically on provisions, but if you haven't looked at them, I won't ask. Thank you.
I just want to come back to that your question about if part of this, the one that you made the request and your evidence about, if part of the site is covered by a Wahi Tupuna overlay, how does that affect the application of those rules over the whole of the site? And at first I thought, I can't really understand that, because the rules clearly say that they only apply to a building or earthworks or whatever if it's in the overlay. But then it occurred to me when you were speaking just before that the earthworks rule, if that's what, and I just want to make sure this is what you're thinking about, applies across the site. So say if it was a rural zone, it would have been 1,000 square metres per site per year, I think is what it was, per 12-month period. And so if the Wahitupuna went over part of the site, then the rule would say in that part of the site, 10 cubic metres, I mean, I always get this wrong, cubic metres per site per year. And is that where you're finding it confusing? Like, the rule applies to the site, even though it's only triggered in part of the site. And how do you know if your overall site is 1,000 or 10 cubic metres?
I think the confusion's there.
Is that what you're referring to?
Yes, it is. The definition of site actually applies in almost every chapter,
yes,
for almost every activity. Yes. So to have an overlay over part of a site, I think
which
it is crazy.
Which is applied at a site level, yeah. Because, I mean, if you've got a building, like a farm building, and it's required to be set back, for example, well, then if you're in the overlay, it applies, and if you're not in the overlay, it doesn't apply. Yeah. That's sort of clearer, but it's sort of where the rule relates to a site that
I got advice on it from the council during notification, and they said that it, the overlay where it dissects the site includes the whole site, and then I've had post discussions after that where the advice has been different, so that leads me to think it needs to be clarified.
It may depend on the nature of the rule and what the rule says, whether the rule applies over the whole site or it only applies to the particular building or
fence
post or whatever.
And I think it comes back to the issue raised by Mr. Gardner-Hopkins before as well. If the overlay traverses part of a site and you embark on a discretionary or non-complying consent, does that therefore mean that those objectives and policies therefore rely to the activity over the whole site, or does that apply to the activity over the layer?
Okay, so that's a slightly different version of your concern.
Yeah. Another implication, I think.
So my last question is, I mean, it comes back to your concern about people having to rely on mana whenua to provide the information for a cultural impact assessment if someone was wanting to do an activity in a Wahitupuna overlay. I mean, isn't that just the way it is? I mean, if the issue at stake was effects on neighbours, for example, and it was something that you needed to know, you know, whether they could see the site, how many times they were woken up at night by noise from the site, wouldn't you need to go and talk to those neighbours as part of a fulsome AE and find out what the effects on those neighbours might be? I mean, that doesn't mean that someone else can't collate that information and lay it down, but, and similarly, because what 5314 says that only Taylor Whenua can identify their relationship, and so you need to go and talk to them and find out what their relationship is. And just like you might have to go and talk to a neighbour to find out what their relationship is. Isn't that just what you do?
Yeah, I'll clarify that. When I was talking about that policy, I didn't actually say I was taking issue with consulting with Mana
Whenua. You're sort of implying that this then meant that that was an unusual sort of directive.
It's unusual.
Constrained your ability to do your own AE.
Well, I do think it does. It does have that outcome, because when you look at sites where there's no evidential basis for what the issue is at the moment, I think trying to investigate that later is putting a burden on the landowner and creates a lot of uncertainty. I've never had an issue with consultation, and I don't have a problem with the process and policies requiring or directing consultation of some degree, but I do believe there should be more upfront information. If you look at your example where you mentioned about talking to a neighbour, if you look at think about how that would work in a context of an urban zone, there's already setbacks and heights and buildings.
Say it said maintenance of rural amenity values. That's what the policy said, and that was a matter you had to go and take into account. I mean, in a rural sense, it might not be entirely clear how, it might say maintenance of amenity neighbours for neighbouring properties, for example. That's a very common type of general policy, which would require you to go and talk to the neighbours and find out how a particular proposal might affect their amenity values.
Yeah. I, I, I agree in part, but very often when you see those types of policies, there's also a lead objective with a number of other policies that are more directive, I find, especially in this PDP. I just find that when you've got a policy directing that really that only one party can identify those values, as I say, I don't have a problem with that, that's what the policy says. That's what we're dealing with. It would be much more efficient, in my view, if we had more information up front to identify what those likely values are going to be prior to undertaking that consultation. As it stands at the moment, if you've got a part of the layer traversing part of your property, you may not know what those values are.
Thank you. And I mean, just to make it clear, I'm not questioning Mana Whenua's expertise in the subject or the values that they hold as a land. I'm just trying to explore the practicalities of administering the plan. In your experience as a practitioner, how do you feel about the practicalities of administering the proposed rules? I mean, do you see challenges there?
I've had very good experiences with consultation and obtaining affected persons' approvals. By and large, I haven't had a problem at all. I have had circumstances where there's been different views within the group that's been consulted, and that's posed issues and led to difficult outcomes. But across the board, I don't have an issue with the consultation process which this policy directs.
You touched with your colleague about, I suppose, the inconsistencies across the different zones, so the treatment of the different zones, particularly the special zones and versus the residential zones, for instance. Do you have a view on whether those other zones should still be mapped for Wāhi Te Puna, but provisions be made to treat the activities differently, to acknowledge the entitlements under the plan or the existing activities?
I think to go back a few steps on it probably goes back to what I mentioned in my summary. I think that having a standalone chapter that sits over top of other zones is problematic. I think having these same matters included within existing chapters, respective of the zones, so those objectives and policies can be looked at as a package, I think would be a lot more efficient process, and that may well lead to having a Wāhi Te Puna overlay over a range of zones, but I think that layer would be much more informed in the policy sense if that approach was taken.
So that in the way that landscape is dealt with in the rural zone, that you would have some provisions for Mana Whenua values within the rural zone?
Yeah, correct.
And the other.
And it's not uncommon to see restricted discretionary activities and controlled activities have matters of control and discretion as cultural values. That's already contained throughout the PDP. It would allow that to be further looked at in light of Chapter 5, I think. To put the microscope on things a little bit more detail.
Thank you. I think that's all for now. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Giddens. Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, you have filed a brief from Mr. Simpson, but as I understand the purpose of the brief, it was merely to give us an illustration of the Kingston position.
That's correct, and it wasn't intended to call Mr. Simpson to just simply confirm the photographs that were attached.
Thank you, Mr. Gardner-Hopkins. To Mr. Giddens. Mr. Gardner-Hopkins, we've run over time significantly. I trust that won't be necessary in the Stream 18 hearing.
No, I'll do better next time.
Yes, but this is in the I must try harder category. Thank you very much. I think we're in need of a cup of tea, but we'll take a quick break. Is that Mr. Thompson? Is scheduled next?
Mr. Williams.
Oh, sorry, Mr. Williams. Mr. Gavin Hopkins. See you again.